Hi, Dave Emery here. This is, for the record, program number 855, Greek Tragedy, Part 3. This is being recorded on July 19th of the year 2015. In this program, we're going to analyze not only the recent Brussels agreement about Greece, its membership in the European Monetary Union, and the EU, its economy, its political system, but we're going to be taking a look at those events or that development in the context not only of the history of 20th and 21st century fascism, but in particular we are going to be taking a look at that development in the context of the theories of German military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz, and we're going to be looking at Prussian military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz, and we're going to look at the application of those military strategic theories to the economic and political spheres. We're also going to be taking a look at the history of the development of a German plan for not only European but ultimately world domination through the creation of a central European economic entity controlled by Germany to control, first of all, Europe and eventually the world itself. We're going to review some history of the development of that plan from the 19th century formulations of Friedrich Least, last name L-I-S-T, on up through World War I, World War II, the Third Reich, the post-war Federal Republic, and we're going to take a look at a chilling but little regarded event that took place in late 2011. The Troika, meaning the IMF, the European Commission, and the European Central Bank, mandated that a fascist party in Greece, the Laos Party, that's L as in Larry, A as in Apple, O as in Owl, S as in Sunset, having nothing to do with the Eastern European country, the Southeast Asian country of the same name. It is an acronym. It is headed up by a Holocaust denier named George Karatsaferis, who said to the Israeli ambassador to Greece, quote, "Jew ambassador, be careful where you tread with these fairy tales of Auschwitz and Dachau." And a member of that party, Makis Varidis, who became first a minister of agriculture, or of infrastructure, I should say, eventually became minister of health after jumping parties. And again, this took place without the citizens of Greece, the cradle of democracy, having any say whatsoever in the inclusion of this doctrinaire fascist political party in the provisional government that was installed in late 2011 by the IMF, European Commission, and European Central Bank, read Germany. We are going to see a continuity in the co-option of Greek sovereignty, because indeed, as I'm speaking on July 19th of 2015, hashtag this is a coup is spreading over social media, and indeed the agreement pretty much eliminates national sovereignty, political sovereignty for Greece with regard to economic matters. And we're going to take a look as well at Wolfgang Schäuble. He is the German finance minister and an individual who had much to do with the creation of some of these structures that gradually and incrementally expanded German political and economic influence in Europe. That expansion was done in accordance with the theories of Karl von Clausewitz and before him Friedrich Least, and this was done as an element of continuity with German governments stretching all the way back to von Bismarck, going up through World War I and World War II, in a brilliant application of the war and post-war theories of Karl von Clausewitz. Suffice it to say that a fellow named Theodore Viper, V-E-I-P-E-R, a Third Reich expert on cross-border political and economic operations, was one of the top advisors to Wolfgang Schäuble when he was a German economic and political official in the 1980s, and laying the political groundwork for what has taken place. So when we are looking at Wolfgang Schäuble, we are looking at someone who essentially has been literally conferring on the sidelines with Third Reich economic and political experts. We're also going to take a look at an interesting exchange that took place at a meeting of the Council on Foreign Relations, where Wolfgang Schäuble, not a meeting, but an event hosted by them, at which Wolfgang Schäuble was addressing the assembled crowd, and Lucy Commissar, who is a frequent contributor on this program, basically braced Wolfgang Schäuble about national debt and Germany's role in devastating Greece economically during the Second World War. And we're going to take a look at the deep national hypocrisy that Germany has manifested with regard to debt forgiveness, basically winning the forgiveness of massive debt after World War II so that Germany could become part of the Atlantic community and take part in the Cold War. And then that will be contrasted with Greece. Please note that the description for the record program number 855 will have information not included in the original program. So please do take advantage of that. So we're going to be taking a look again at the continuity between the past and the present. And we're going to take a look at just exactly what has actually happened with regard to Greece. And it is quite stunning to see how basically democracy could be waved away by international financial bureaucratic officialdom, and the mainstream press can, to a large extent, simply look elsewhere. To give you an idea, however, of some of the reaction that has been taking place in Europe, as well as a synoptic account of German economic hegemony in Europe and how it developed, and in particular, the role of Wolfgang Schäuble as his position within the German political and economic hierarchy advanced, and the extent to which his actions on the European and international stage basically result from his consultation with a Third Reich veteran and implementation of a Third Reich playbook. An excellent article from GermanForeignPolicy.com from July 15th of 2014. GermanForeignPolicy.com feeds along the lower right-hand side of the front page of the website. This is called The Brussels Agreement, again from July 15th, 2014, and it reads in part as follows. In several Western and Southern European countries, the agreement on Greece reached in Brussels signals a looming collapse of the continental post-war order, as well as Germany's revival as an ostentatious dictatorial power. Whereas social democratic observers do not exclude an attenuation of these contradictions, Southern European conservative media are among those who speak of a revival of German hegemonic ambitions, which have largely determined or triggered the First and Second World Wars. The consequences of the French and Italian submission during negotiations in Brussels are generating these fears because Paris had not succeeded to, and Rome had not even seriously attempted to, thwart the German dictates of sovereignty over Greece. Both Italy and France are aware of the dangers of becoming the next victim of German financial dictatorship. Both France and Italy are competing for admission to a Northern European core Europe whose membership will be decided by Berlin in the case of a possible collapse of the European Union. Current events are directly linked to German foreign policy endeavors in the 1990s and the territorial expansion of Germany's economic basis through the so-called reunification of Germany. Commentators of diverse political orientations speak of a revival of German hegemonic ambitions. In Italy, for example, following the negotiations in Brussels, the liberal La Repubblica carried the headline, Greece has its back to the wall, unquote, and noted, again quoting, the Eurogroup is in the hands of German hawks, unquote. Athens is confronted with, quote, a series of dictates, one harsher than the other, unquote. Hawks are triumphantly circling in the European skies, the article continues, and impose an impossible ultimatum on Tsipras, similar to the one Austria imposed on the Serbs, which triggered the First World War. The end of innocence has been reached because everyone in the EU knows without a doubt who the real ringmaster is, the Italian conservative Il Messaggero wrote. The real ringmaster is Germany. The conservative paper continues, Sedan is returning. That was where the German forces broke through in World War II. Sedan is returning. When Germany trampled on France in 1870 and later did not follow Bismarck's advice not to make enemies both in the East and the West at the same time. In fact, Germany made, quote, enemies everywhere after World War I, Il Messaggero recalled, except perhaps in Northern Europe's vassal states in the 1930s, temporarily Poland, which because of its own painful history, though it could not act otherwise, then direct its hatred toward the Russians. The commentator concluded, the burden of history has returned and seems insurmountable, unquote. And a French left-wing politician, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, Twittered over the weekend, for the third time in history, the stubbornness of a German government is in the process of destroying Europe, unquote, skipping down. However, the fact that Berlin had not begun in 2015 to threaten with a further radicalization of its aggressive economic and financial policy. This fact has remained largely in the background. In fact, current events are directly linked to German foreign policy endeavors in the 1990s and the territorial expansion of Germany's economic basis through reunification. According to a popular myth, the latter, German reunification, was bought by German Chancellor at the time Helmut Kohl's consent to the introduction of the uniform EU currency, the euro. In fact, Bonn had only consented to the common currency under the condition, as a contemporary observer of the event remembers, that, quote, the rules governing the monetary union and the European central banking system be primarily oriented on the model of German rules and the German Federal Bank, unquote. The euro speaks German, unquote, declared the German Minister of Finance, Theo Weigel, in 1998. Thanks to the euro, with its specifically German patent, the Federal Republic of Germany has been able to take full advantage of its economic strength in relationship to the other countries in the Eurozone and drive many of them into a debt-inducing excessive foreign trade deficit. In 2014, approximately 34.5 billion euros flowed from France to Germany, and Greece was still transferring more than 3.2 billion euros. The German austerity dictate, which ultimately ensures the flow of currency into the Federal Republic of Germany, are a result of the German patent on the euro imposed back in the 1990s.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
In the 1990s, Wolfgang Schäuble, who today administered the austerity dictate as German Minister of Finances, had also played a role in creating the German power base, which has permitted Berlin's consistent clean sweep. In the early 1980s, as chair of the Association of European Border Regions, or AEBR, Schäuble had organized the first economic initiatives, and not just toward France, but toward Europe as a whole. Theodor Theodor Weicher, V-E-I-T-E-R, a former Nazi specialist for border subversion, was one of Wolfgang Schäuble's advisors when he was chair of the AEBR. This last sentence again. Theodor Weicher, a former Nazi specialist for border subversion, was one of Schäuble's advisors as chair of the AEBR. On a reinforced basis, following the collapse of Europe's socialist system and the downfall of the Soviet alliance, the annexation of the German Democratic Republic, Schäuble insisted on imposing the EU's eastward expansion.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
And then again, in the rest of this post, there is discussion of the creation of a core Europe. This basically, in the event of a collapse of the EMU and the EU, there would be a consortium of strong Northern European countries, chiefly Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, and Switzerland, that would form the basis of a sort of a new alliance. And both France and Italy are scrambling to become part of that. To give an idea of just how stunning the conditions that were imposed on Greece were, we're going to take a look at an article from the Huffington Post of July 12th, 2015, authored by Ryan, R-Y-A-N, Grimm, G-R-I-M, German-led Eurogroup launching coup against Greek government. And it reads in part as follows, skipping down. With Germany and its Eurozone squeezing the life out of Greece on Sunday night and the hashtag "This is a coup" trending, it became clearer than ever that only half of that bargain, the economics, remained alive. That sort of alludes to a grand bargain in which political freedom and economics would be maintained. Continuing. The world's rich nations assumed that what institutions like the IMF did in the South wouldn't hit the North, however. Capital marched on, and on Sunday night it marched into Athens with an offer to Greece that would end the idea that capitalism and democracy can survive together in that country. Reads the offer provided by a source close to the talks from the European financial elite, which call themselves, quote, the institutions, unquote, quote, "The Greek government needs to consult and agree with the institutions on all draft legislation in relevant areas with adequate time before submitting it for public consultation or to the Greek parliament," unquote. It would be a government in name only. Not only would the Greek people be forced to accept the kind of deal they rejected overwhelmingly at the polls just a week earlier, but they would be blocked from implementing any future policies Germany disapproved of. Skipping down. During negotiations over the future of Greece, the Greek Syriza government repeatedly offered such progressive taxation as a way of achieving some of the budget surpluses the institutions were demanding. That offer of progressive taxation was rejected, however, with the institutions arguing that higher taxes on the rich might slow growth. Interesting. Skipping down. Have we heard this before? Paul Krugman of the New York Times, under the headline "Killing the European Project," put the blame squarely on Germany. Quote, the trending hashtag, this is a coup, is exactly right. This goes beyond harsh into pure vindictiveness, complete destruction of national sovereignty, and no hope of relief. It is presumably meant to be an offer Greece can't accept, but even so, it's a grotesque betrayal of everything the European project was supposed to stand for. Skipping down again. Yanis Varoufakis, the economist who was until recently Greece's finance minister, said in a blog post Sunday that his German counterpart, Wolfgang Schäuble, flat out told him that his end goal was to ease Greece out of the eurozone in order to teach a lesson to other nations that might want to pursue political paths at odds with Schäuble's vision. Fox Business reported Sunday that the IMF was demanding that Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras resign, a claim the bank later denied. Italy's Prime Minister, meanwhile, begged Germany to call off the dogs. Quote, now common sense must prevail and an agreement must be reached. Italy does not want Greece to exit the euro, and to Germany I say enough is enough, unquote. Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi said, again quoting, now that Tsipras has made proposals in line with the European demands, we must absolutely sign a deal. Humiliating a European partner after Greece has given up just about everything is unthinkable, unquote. And in answer to that, the following, this is from the Washington Post of July 12, 2015. Germany doesn't want to save Greece. It seems to want to humiliate Greece. And skipping down in this article. The problem is that The problem is that Greece's economy is in so much worse shape now than it was even a few weeks ago that the tax hikes and spending cuts, which would have produced a 1% budget surplus before, won't anymore. That's what happens, after all, when the European Central Bank pulls enough of the plug on your banks that they have to close their doors for now to avoid having to close their doors for good. Businesses can't get the credit they need to, well, stay in business, and will then default on the banks that are about to go out of business themselves. The entire economy, in other words, shuts down. And that's why Europe estimates that Greece would actually need an 82 billion euro bailout, with 25 billion of that going to its banks instead of the 53.5 billion euros Athens is asking for. So Greece would have to do more austerity than Europe wanted before to get more money than Europe was offering before. If that is, Europe is even offering Greece any money anymore, and it might not be. And still more, again, these words are not my own. These are coming from relatively mainstream commentators, even people on the right. Columnist Ambrose Evans Pritchard of the Daily Telegraph in the UK of July 13th, 2015. Greece is being treated like a hostile, occupied state. I'm skipping down. The cruel capitulation forced upon Greece after 31 hours on the diplomatic rack offers no conceivable way out of the country's perpetual crisis. The terms are harsher by a full order of magnitude than those rejected by Greek voters in a landslide referendum a week ago, and therefore can never command democratic assent. EMU inspectors can veto legislation. These are some of the provisions of the Brussels Agreement. EMU inspectors can veto Greek domestic legislation. The emasculation of the Greek Parliament has been slipped into the actual text. All that is missing is a unit of EMU gendarmes. And we'll see if that eventually happens. Skipping down again. In other words, they are seizing Greece's few remaining sources. Well, that would be, of course, sources of income and wealth. It's going to be, again, very, very, very interesting to see what develops. More words from Paul Krugman, again, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and columnist for the New York Times, of the agreement. This goes beyond harsh in the pure vindictiveness, complete destruction of national sovereignty, and no hope of relief. It is presumably meant to be an offer Greece can't accept, but even so, it's a grotesque betrayal of everything the European project was supposed to stand for. Well, I would argue that what actually is taking place is pretty much what was really meant by the European Monetary Union and the EU. It should be known that this really, as we have spoken about so many times, and we've talked about this in, among other programs, for the record, 746, Greek Tragedy Part 1, and 748, Greek Tragedy Part 2. We have spoken about not only the policies of von Clausewitz, but a long-standing plan for German economic hegemony that was forced, that was created and formulated, I should say, in the mid-19th century by Friedrich Liszt. And it has developed over the years. We're going to outline that in just, actually, we might as well do that right now and then go back to our main focal point here. What is worth noting is that the growth of what we know of as the European Union and the European Monetary Union are actually the outgrowth of a plan that was formulated in the 19th century and then using the principles of Karl von Clausewitz, developed through two world wars and post-wars and the Cold War, and are being implemented right now. For this, I want to recommend a number of books that are available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Reading now from The Thousand-Year Conspiracy by Paul Winkler, put out in hardcover by Charles Scribner and Sons, copyright 1943, we read the following. And again, this book is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website in the books section. Charles Andler, A-N-D-L-E-R, a French author, summed up certain ideas of Friedrich Liszt in his work The Origins of Pan-Germanism, published in 1915. Quote, "It is necessary to organize continental Europe against England. Napoleon I, a great strategist, also knew the methods of economic hegemony. His continental system, which met with opposition even from the countries which might have profited from such an arrangement, should be revived, but this time not as an institution of Napoleonic domination. The idea of united Europe in a closed trade bloc is no longer shocking if Germany assumes domination of such a bloc and not France. Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, wittingly or by force, will enter this customs federation," unquote. "Austria is assumed to be won over right from the outset. Even France, if she gets rid of her notions of military conquest, will not be excluded. The first steps the Confederation would take to assure unity of thought and action would be to establish a joint representative body as well as to organize a common fleet. But, of course, both the headquarters of the Federation and its parliamentary seat would be in Germany."
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing in, but by no means exclusively, economic and financial matters.
Back again from the book The Thousand-Year Conspiracy by Paul Winkler, and that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Reading now from the Germany Watch blog of June 11th of 2013, talking about the realization of these theories through the First World War. Being quoted here is German Chancellor Beitmann Hollweg, Beitmann Hollweg, B-E-T-H-M-A-N, Hollweg, H-O-L-L-W-E-G. Again, from the article, World War I Centenary, Historical Revision in British Government Circles, from Germany Watch of June 11, 2013, quoting Beitmann Hollweg. And this again, during the First World War, September of 1914. We must create a Central European Economic Association through common customs treaties to include France, Belgium, Holland, Denmark, Austria, Hungary, Poland, and perhaps Italy, Sweden, and Norway. This association will not have any common constitutional supreme authority, and all its members will be formally equal, but in practice will be under German leadership and must stabilize Germany's economic dominance over Middle Europe. That again during World War One. Now going up to the run-up to America's involvement in World War II from another book that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. This, Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens, published in hardcover by Henry Schumann, copyright 1953. This is from an article by Dorothy Thompson in the Wall Street Journal of May 31st of 1941, on the eve of America's involvement in World War One. The Germans have a clear plan of what they intend to do in case of victory. I believe that I know the essentials of that plan. I have heard it from a sufficient number of important Germans to credit its authenticity. Germany's plan is to make a customs union of Europe with complete financial and economic control centered in Berlin. This will create at once the largest free trade area and the largest planned economy in the world. In Western Europe alone, there will be an economic unity of 400 million persons. To these will be added the resources of the British, French, Dutch, and Belgian empires. This will be pooled in the name of Europa Germanica. The Germans count upon political power following economic power and not vice versa. Territorial changes do not concern them because there will be no France or England except as language groups. Little immediate concern is felt regarding political organizations as well. No nation will have the control of its own financial or economic system or of its customs. The Nazification of all countries will be accomplished by economic pressure. In all countries, contacts have been established long ago with sympathetic businessmen and industrialists. As far as the United States is concerned, the planners of the World Germanica laugh off the idea of any armed invasion. They say that it will be completely unnecessary to take military action against the United States to force it to play ball with this system. Here, as in every other country, they have established relations with numerous industries and commercial organizations to whom they will offer advantages in cooperation with Germany. Again, Dorothy Thompson writing on May 31st, 1941, and that's on the eve of World War One, of America's entrance into World War II. A little over a year and a half, roughly a year and a half before Pearl Harbor. And this plan continued to take place during the Second World War proper. Repeating from the, and this is, there's an archive online, the European Economic Community, or Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft. And this is quoting the German Secretary of State, Gustav Koenigs, by the way, G-U-S-T-A-V-K-O-E-N-I-G-S, and a 1942 conference about European Economic Community. So again, the Secretary of State of Nazi Germany, who also was one of the key people involved with the Hamburg America Line, one of the Bush family Nazi businesses. We saw this, by the way, in For the Record 802. This is what Gustav Koenigs had to say about this during World War II. At the moment, the so-called European Economic Community is not yet fact. There is no pact, no organization, no council, and no general secretary. However, it is not just part of our imagination or some dream of a politician. It is very real. Its roots are in the economic cooperation of the European nations, and it will develop after the war into a permanent European community. Unquote. Again, 1942, as spoken by the Third Reich's Secretary of State. And near the end of the war, a document that was captured, a Nazi document. This, again, from another book available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens. This is a document talking about the dying, or really the waning Nazi Germany that was preparing to go underground. And the document is called The European Peace Order, and skipping down. And Principle 5, European Union on a federalistic basis. But these are the goals of Nazi Germany in the post-war period. And number 7, European Commonweal or Gemeinnutz, that's Commonwealth. And a European Court of Arbitration, that's very similar to the ICC, which is being funded by Germany. And skipping down to number 12, Economic Integration of Europe. Again, this is from a Third Reich document right near the end of the war. And, well, it has happened. One of the things that is interesting, too, is that Germany was able to get its debt forgiven. Now, after the Second World War, again, we took a look at not only Gustav Koenig's pronouncements during World War II, but the goals of the Third Reich as it was going underground at the end of World War II. Getting its debt forgiven was one of the things that Germany was able to do at the London Conference of 1953. That basically forgave the enormous debt that Germany had rolled up until German reunification. That, of course, did not take place till 1990. I forgot when it was actually formally implemented, but it didn't take place for a long time. A point that the Greeks were making in recent months was that Germany had stolen a tremendous amount of money, looted basically, a tremendous amount of money from Greece during World War II, and that if part or all of that was repaid, that would have taken care of the Greek debt under the dictates of the European Monetary Union. There is an expert on debt, Albrecht Rietschel, or Rietschel, R-I-T-S-C-H-L, at the London School of Economics. We have quoted him before, and he noted of the forgiveness of debt that was accorded Germany at the end of World War II. This is from a post on Lucy Commissar's blog, The Commissar Scoop, of April 18th, 2015. German Finance Minister Schäuble spins why Greeks have to pay back loans and Germany doesn't. Again, this is by Lucy Commissar. Now, I'm going to telescope much of what is being said here. Lucy Commissar basically is pointing out that at an address to the CFR, Wolfgang Schäuble was saying basically that there has to be continuity, that governments basically are responsible for the actions of their predecessors. And when someone asked him if this meant that Germany bore responsibility for debt incurred by the Third Reich, he equivocated, and he was braced by a number of people, including Lucy Commissar, when she spoke of the enormous debt that Germany was forgiven at the end of World War II. And quoting Albert Reitschel, again from the London School of Economics, quote, Reitschel said, quote, if we accept that Germany's national product is somewhere to the tune of over 2 trillion euros, which is beyond 2.5 trillion U.S. dollars, we will be talking about a default and debt forgiveness of somewhere in the range of $10 trillion. I would tend to think that this is probably unrivaled in 20th century history. And again, he is talking about the amount of debt that Germany had rolled up during World War II, and that was then, if not forgiven, deferred for further action until after German reunification. This was from the London Conference of 1953. That's when the debt was, basically when debt relief was implemented for Germany. And it was some 40 years or so later when Germany reunified. And again, when Wolfgang Schäuble was talking to the CFR, he was saying basically, well, the Greeks have to pay the debt that was incurred by previous governments because there is a continuity of responsibility that governments have. It doesn't matter if the previous government is no longer in power. Other governments have to honor the financial commitments they made. And once again, when he was asked about, well, doesn't that mean that Germany is responsible for the debt incurred by the Third Reich, he became equivocal. And remember what we looked at in our article with which we began this program, the Brussels Agreement from GermanForeignPolicy.com of July 15th, basically in setting the blueprint for German cross-border economic expansion. Wolfgang Schäuble relied on the advice of von Theodor Reiter, V-E-I-T-E-R, a Third Reich specialist in cross-border subversion, which is, well, that is more than a little interesting. Recall, too, that when we read about the blowing off of Greek democratic institutions, basically, the Greek people and the Greek government no longer will have any real say over their affairs under this agreement. This is, I wouldn't so much call it a coup. The hashtag this is a coup is trending. I would really would call it hashtag this isn't foreign, this is an occupation, except they're using capital instead of tanks and dive bombers this time around. This, too, however, lies on something of a continuity or a continuum with what took place earlier. Again, in late 2011, Greece had a provisional government imposed on it by the Troika, again, the IMF, the European Central Bank, and the European Commission, read Germany. And, well, it was a stunning thing because an explicitly fascist party was incorporated into that government. We're going to talk about that in just a sec.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site also features many articles not included in programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
By way of review, reading now from GermanForeignPolicy.com from December 21st of 2011. Recently, a right-wing extremist party was again made a direct coalition partner in a country's government in Greece. The newly installed transitional government imposed under the supervision of Berlin and Brussels includes not only the conservative and social democratic parties, but also the Laos, Parlamentarikos, Orthodoxos, Sinajerim, or Orthodox People's Alarm. The Laos Party musters also partisans of the former military dictatorship and is known for its racist and anti-Semitic invectives. Georgios Kalatsoferis, Laos Party chairperson, is quoted to have proclaimed that he is proud, quote, not to be Jewish, homosexual, and communist, unquote, which, quote, only few can claim, unquote. He is said to have called out to the Israeli ambassador, Jew ambassador, watch out where you tread. Let's discuss the Holocaust. Let's talk about the fairy tales about Auschwitz and Dachau. Makis Voridis, a member of the Laos Party and Minister of Transportation in the Greek government imposed by Berlin and Brussels, began his political career as the leader of a youth organization of the party presided over by George Papadopoulos. Papadopoulos had been the military commander of the junta, and Voridis founded a political party after the junta fell, which was dedicated to perpetuating the politics of that junta. And eventually, Makis the Hammer Voridis jumped political parties and became the Minister of Health in Greece. The health situation in Greece is so bad that basically, as we looked at in For the Record 788, physical education teachers in Greece are no longer making their students participate in class because they get weak if they do. If you go to a hospital in Greece, you have to bring your own pillowcases and sheets and blankets because the cleaning staff has been so cut back because of austerity cuts that basically you no longer get those in the hospital. Only wealthy Greeks can afford to bury their dead now. There's even a proposal that was put forth to have young Greeks work for free in order to get basically to get them at work in Greek corporations, and Greek youth who couldn't work for free or for whom there were not enough, quote, free, unquote, openings were going to be shipped out of the country. You know, to where and to do what was never specified. More about the Hammer, Makis the Hammer Voridis. From Pando Daily of June 15th, 2014, an article by Mark Ames. Yacht apps and anti-Semitic ministers in the birthplace of democracy. Again, this about Makis Voridis, who was part of the Laos Party that was installed as part of the Greek transitional slash provisional government, and then eventually jumped parties and became the Greek Minister of Health. Greece, skipping down, Greece's pro-EU ruling Conservative Party, the New Democrats, just named an actual neo-Nazi, Makis the Hammer Voridis, as Greece's new health minister. Jewish groups are outraged over the news that Voridis, a long-time neo-fascist and neo-fascist activist and anti-Semite, who has publicly promoted the protocols of the Elders of Zion as worthy of scholarship, and doubted the authenticity of the Diary of Anne Frank, is serving as a prominent minister in the ruling party's cabinet, in charge of an important ministry at a time when Greece has been cutting its health care budgets, causing widespread ministry. I wrote about Voridis in November of 2011 because I was shocked that the government coalition essentially imposed on Greece by the EU and Western creditors would demand that allegedly technocratic austerity coalition include members of Greece's anti-Semitic, neo-fascist Laos Party, including Makis the Hammer Voridis, who served as Minister of Infrastructure and Transport. That last passage again. I wrote about Voridis in November of 2011, because I was shocked that the government coalition essentially imposed on Greece by the EU and Western creditors would demand that the allegedly technocratic austerity coalition, unquote, include members of Greece's anti-Semitic, neo-fascist Laos Party. And again, so when we see essentially the complete dissolution of the substance of democracy in Greece, again, when we see that the, quote, institutions, unquote, will have primacy in Greece, and basically the Greek people, the Greek government, should they disagree with what the institutions, unquote, have to say, basically they can shove it. They have no say in their own economic governance. And recall basically what the Third Reich's plan was for domination of Europe, as written by about by Dorothy Thompson in the New York Herald Tribune of May 31st, 1940. Economic control leads automatically to political control. Now, I have alluded to the theories of Karl von Clausewitz and his concept of wars and post-wars. The theories of von Clausewitz are inextricably linked with the history of German political and economic expansion. In Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and the numerous supplements to that broadcast that talks about how Germany took advantage of the international cartel system in order to basically gain the international trade markets in such a way as to put itself in an advantageous position and to put its adversaries in a disadvantageous position. In the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and in, For the Record, 305, that excerpts key parts of that book, we took a look at how the theories of von Clausewitz were put into effect during the occupation of Europe. And even though the Third Reich lost World War II on the battlefield, they looted all of the liquid wealth of Europe and restructured the corporate landscape of the countries that they occupied in such a way as after the war, the economies, the corporate economies of those countries would be dominated by German corporations, which in turn would be right back in an advantageous position in the international cartel system. To get a feeling of how this works, we're going to once again excerpt a book that is available for download for free from the SpitfireList.com website. It's a book called Germany's Master Plan, The Story of an Industrial Offensive by Joseph Borken and Charles A. Welch, hardcover, copyright 1944. And they write, the authors write on pages 16 and 17, Germany has long understood this strategy of total war. Karl von Clausewitz, the father of modern German militarism, set out its major premise in when he said, quote, war is no independent thing. The main lineaments of all great strategic plans are of a political nature. The more so, the more they include the totality of war and the state. To von Clausewitz, peace was a continuation of war by other means. In effect, he said to Germany, disarm your enemy in peace by diplomacy and trade if you would conquer him more readily on the field of battle. This philosophy of war in peace became the keynote of Germany's political and economic intercourse with other nations. These tenets explain why twice within a generation, again they're writing in 1944, we have entered war not only facing the might of German armies, but shackled by economic bondage to German industry. German-controlled cartels were at all times the servants of German national interest. That their loyalty to Germany was undivided explains the uniformity of the agreements which they made. Germany's industrial attack in World War II had as its cardinal purpose the reversal of blockade. Patents and secret know-how were used to bar our access to our own technology. Skipping down. To businesses in the U.S., England, and France, international cartels were an efficient means of guaranteeing monopoly. Industrialists outside of Germany thought in terms of low output, high prices, and maximum profits. They regarded divisions of both territory and fields of production as comfortable and easily policed methods by which they could free themselves from competition and create spheres of monopoly. Think about the trade agreements that are in place today and one looming large with Europe and Germany. The authors also write, wherever there was a cartel before, in 1942, there was a military shortage. The Army and Navy petitioned civilians to turn in binoculars and lenses. The Baruch Committee reported that if we do not solve the synthetic rubber problem, we face a, quote, civilian and military collapse. The gallant stand of MacArthur's men on Bataan became more desperate because they found themselves without quinine. The growing priority lists of chemicals and plastics were an inventory of cartels. When we tried to tool up our new factories with every second of passing time working against us, the lack of tungsten carbide blunted the edge of our effort. The roster of scarce materials and the absence of substitutes had a common cause, unquote. These shortages speak volumes for the brilliant planning of the German offensive. In the first, quote, report to the nation, unquote, issued January 14, 1942, by the Office of Facts and Figures, says, quote, the enemy has worked for many years to weaken our military potential. Through patent controls and cartel agreements, he succeeded in limiting American production and export of many vital materials. He kept the prices of these materials up and the output down. He was waging war, and he did his work well, destroying important American companies one after another with agreements, the purpose of which those companies did not sense. The list of materials affected is long. Beryllium, optical instruments, magnesium, tungsten carbide, pharmaceuticals, hormones, dyes, and many more. When you match each product with its military use, the significance of the attack becomes clear. And again, this by way of showing how German industry, using the cartels that their foreign competitors thought were simply vehicles for maximizing profit and reducing competition, this shows how German corporations, using those same cartel systems, were able to game the international strategic marketplace to Germany's advantage. And again, the continuum from war to peace and the post-war and the theories of von Clausewitz are fundamental here. And I emphatically encourage listeners to use the various books that are available for download for free on the website. Also, keep your eyes peeled for the updates from people like Terra Fractal. They will be an invaluable source of information in weeks to come. Be aware, again, that each For the Record program is turned into a long article-length description, frequently featuring information that is not in the original broadcast. So if some of this material seems a little bit incomprehensible or the presentation is overly pedantic, please go to the SpitfireList.com website and use the descriptions. All the material on the SpitfireList.com website is available for download for free. This concludes For the Record program number 855, Greek Tragedy Part 3, being recorded on July 19th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.